All right, we'll go ahead and get started. Thank you all for coming. I know it's really easy to spend the afternoon in sunny Phoenix, especially after we've seen Mr. Manning, both Mr. Mannings. But we're really glad you came. This is going to be, a really good session. You've heard over and over again today, if you've come to any of the nerd sessions, the econ sessions, how important trade is to U.S. agriculture. About 25% of the value of our production is exported. If you want to think about that in real terms, what that means is if this room represents all of agriculture, the first like five rows of you can quit farming if we don't have export markets. Yeah. we're not taking volunteers because we need those markets. But one of the markets that I think has long been elusive to the United States and has been a lot of interest is the Cuba market. And today we're joined by two experts on Cuba. Dr. Steven Zeisner is from USDA ERS, and he's going to give us an overview of a bit the opportunities and the past relationship with Cuba. And Mari Caro is the regional director for the U.S. Grains Council covering the Western Hemisphere. She is based in Panama and came here to deliver her message to us today. And it's her job to think about what the market is for U.S. grains in that developing market as maybe some of the political situations change. So without further ado, Stephen, I'd invite you up and we'll get started.
All right. Wonderful, Veronica. Thank you so much for extending the invitation on behalf of the Farm Bureau. I notice a lot of people usually introduce themselves as where they grew up. So I grew up in northeast Nebraska, and my mom and dad were teachers when they were working. My mom taught in my high school, and my dad taught at a small college called Wayne State College in Wayne, Nebraska. Obviously, northeast Nebraska is a prominent farming area, and the interest in that stuck, and so here I am. I'm a little bit different from some people who study Cuba in that I've not actually been to Cuba. I look at Cuba as a possible opportunity for liberalizing trade, that we're moving from a position over the past, 20 years of having virtually no trade with Cuba to having a substantial amount of agricultural trade, but all on the export side, and all trying to fit within the constraints of the economic embargo that's on Cuba. So I'll talk a little bit about what agricultural trade with Cuba was like before the Cuban Revolution and what it looks like now. And one of the things that was really fun, one of my coworkers and I, we looked at some really old U.S. agricultural trade data to see what was the relationship like just before the Cuban Revolution. And today we export about $220 million worth of agricultural product to Cuba. And in terms of how much that weighs, that's about two-thirds of what was exported just before the revolution. The product composition has shifted a little bit since then. The U.S. traditional comparative advantages are in grains and oilseeds and meat, and there was rice exports, wheat exports, pork exports before the revolution. Soybean trade was certainly not as prominent as it is today internationally, so there was negligible amount. So now you have the bulk of U.S. exports being focused in four commodities, chicken meat, soy meal, soybeans, and corn. And that's kind of an unusual circumstance. When you think about these commodities, they're obviously ones where the U.S. competes well on price, competes well on quality, and the Cubans are aware of that, but it's not normal for the United States just to export four commodities of agricultural products to anybody. The framework that this trade takes place is that around 2000, the Clinton administration got Congress to pass an act called the Trade Sanctions Reform and Export Enhancement Act of 2000, which authorizes U.S. exports of food, medicine, and medical equipment to certain countries, including Cuba, but this law did not provide a legal framework for the resumption of U.S. agricultural imports from Cuba. And one thing that had been done several years before that was that Congress codified the embargo, that is, they put it into law, and they specified very specific conditions that under the act would govern what would need to take place for the embargo to be suspended provisionally or eliminated as entirely. So provisionally, if you had a democratically elected government about to take power in Cuba, that would be enough to provisionally lift the embargo. Once that government was inaugurated, then the embargo would go away. Over the past several years, there has been what the Obama administration calls an updated approach to U.S. relations with Cuba that has included loosening some of the constraints on trade with Cuba. There is authorization of imports of coffee, for instance, if it's produced by independent entrepreneurs, an effort to have a more fluid definition of what cash in advance means in order to make easier to pay for agricultural products. It's okay to establish a physical presence in Cuba on behalf of your export sales, the reestablishment of diplomatic relations. And what to me as a USDA employee has been interesting is there's an MOU between the USDA and its Cuban counterpart, an establishment of a permanent, of a USDA presence in the form of a rotating staff person in the U.S. Embassy. And then there have been some visits to Cuba by USDA subject matter experts. And some of those visits have focused on issues of common interest that don't obey embargoes, like migratory birds carrying avian influenza don't salute the embargo. You know, there's been, I think, some detection of a screw worm in southern Florida, again, not likely to adhere to the embargo. Here you can see the pattern of U.S. agricultural exports to Cuba since that act in 2000 was put into place. And you could see that it peaked in 2008, which was a really difficult year for Cuba in terms of they kept on getting whacked by hurricanes. But then since then, it's tapered off a bit. So the full trade statistics for 2016 haven't come out yet, but if you look at the last 12 months that are available, it looks like for 2016, the total is going to be about $195 million. That's about $45 million higher than 2015, but still a lot smaller than the peak of around $675 million that was experienced in 2008. Now, if you can remember in this previous slide, so look for that pattern in this slide. This is all of Cuba's imports, and you can see where the little blue set of bars in the bottom. And Cuba has gone from the U.S. being really a major supplier to being one of multiple suppliers to the Cuban market. And this is unusual. This is not the way it looks like in Mexico or in Canada or the Dominican Republic or in Colombia. And, the Cubans have adopted an approach of importing from multiple partners, some of whom are willing to extend credit and aren't governed by any restrictions on doing so. So I think it's a fair question to ask, why has there been limited growth recently in U.S. agricultural exports to Cuba? And that's mining, of course, that there has been this increase in 2016. And starting from the bottom of my list is that the embargo remains in place. Also, Cuban economic decision-making is still highly centralized and rests with government entities. Cuba's been lucky to have a drop-off in major hurricane activity recently, and also their lower commodity prices, and Cuba's diversified its suppliers. China and the EU on the export side are the leading buyers of Cuban agricultural exports. China gets a lot of sugar from Cuba. The EU actually imports honey from Cuba, and I find that interesting. Here you can see what happened to Cuba as a sugar producer and exporter once the Soviet Union dissolved and the extremely favorable prices that the Soviets were paying for sugar. The you know, the industry went from being a, you know, an 8 million metric ton industry in Cuba to being a 1 million ton industry, and you're starting to see them sort of coming back up a little bit. And we've read about there being reports of you know, some Brazilian assistance, and you know, some of the sugar can be put into rum, which can be sold to other people. Here's some statistics about Cuba's natural honey exports. The thing that I find interesting about this is that it's it really shows the mixed economy approach. All the producers who are you know, making honey are organized in some type of cooperative. It's sold to a state-owned firm, and that firm does all the exporting. And for a typical Cuban, unless you are actually have honeybees on your, you know, your site, you don't eat much honey. And that's, you know, I think one of the great ironies is Cuba is you know, a good producer of many agricultural products, but it's not widely shared all the time. Here are some statistics for ag-related exports. They have done a fairly impressive job since the turn of the century at reestablishing themselves as exporters of cigars and exporters of rum and tafia, which I think is a low-grade rum that I have not yet tried. Maybe I don't want to. I don't know. And, you know, one thing about rum is, I don't know if people saw recently the program in 60 Minutes where they talked about Havana Club from Cuba and Havana Club from Puerto Rico. One is, as a traveler, able to bring back, you know, a certain amount of rum for one's personal use, but because of that long-standing conflict about who owns the Havana Club name and trademark, you know, it's hard to get to a point where the U.S. is going to be importing rum directly from Cuba right away. So looking in the future, and I don't know what, you know, whether, you know, this is, you know, a long way down the road or nearby in the future, but if one thought about if one established something that was more akin to normal trade relations, what would that look like? Are some other economists at the U.S. International Trade Commission have suggested that you could have an increase in U.S. agricultural exports to Cuba on the order of about $1 billion a year. And they looked at 9 ag commodities plus some food and beverages that USDA normally counts as being agricultural trade. So it could be going from a $200 million market to a $1 billion market. Another possibility is that Cuba starts to look more like countries that are similar to Cuba. And very close to Cuba is the Dominican Republic, about as big as Cuba in terms of the size of its GDP, about the size, same size and population. You know, if you look at purchasing power parity, Cuba's GDP might be a bit higher. I'm not sure if that really holds or not. You know, so, you know, what if Cuba became more like the Dominican Republic? One thing is that you would expect a much more diverse range of commodities exported to Cuba. So here you can see the blue are the levels of trade over the last 3 fiscal years to the Dominican Republic. The orange ones, and this wasn't meant to be Tennessee orange, it just happened on Excel, you know, that Cuba, it's all focused in just those 4 commodities, and that's peculiar. Another thing they point out was that, yes, the share of U.S. agricultural exports to Cuba would rise above its you know, current level of 20%, but it's not clear that it would get as high as it is with the Dominican Republic because the U.S. and the DR have a free trade relationship. And that's one of the reasons why our share is so high. It's 45%. But, you know, again, going back to broadening the commodity composition of our exports, you know, imagining selling rice again to Cuba, wheat, non-fat dried milk, dried beans, that would add to the U.S. share of the Cuban market. And maybe down the road you'd have initiating exports of intermediate and higher value consumer-oriented products, some dedicated to tourism and food services. What could we import? Maybe tobacco, rum, again, not agriculture, but ag-related, honey, if it can sell to the EU, why not us? You know, good climate for growing fruits and vegetables. You had the right negotiated market access, maybe we would import some sugar. Now, that's, you know, these are things that are in the realm of the possibilities over the long term. One thing I wanted to say as a caveat to this is that because Cuba's been isolated from the rest of the economy so world and for so long and sort of in an adversarial relationship to the United States, that their approach to food security has resulted in a unique dietary profile. And one thing that they emphasize is egg consumption and egg production. And so you can see here that even though Cuba's cut off, that you know they consume a little bit more eggs per capita than people in the Dominican Republic do. There's also, I don't know if you can see the meat other category, and I'm not sure exactly what this is, but you know I've read about people eating meats that are not commonly eaten in, say, the United States, you know, like guinea pigs and rabbits. I imagine that horse meat's a possibility here. But what I wanted to say is that you know this is sort of a unique starting point for opening a trade relationship or broadening it in terms of how they're consuming meat today and the meats that they are consuming. Here's some statistics about the poultry sector, and I'm just starting to learn about this. But again, you have a mixed economy approach to production in that you have state firms, associations, family production involved. There are government institutions that are involved in egg production. They have an Institute of Poultry Research that has a National Poultry Genetic Bank. I was told before coming here that they're working with some genetic lines that were imported from Canada in the 50s. So there are chances to modernize this. It's still part of the ration book, and there was an egg rustling operation going on about 5 years ago that resulted in some people going to jail. And you know, because this is viewed as a strategic sector, that they're really tight on you know, making sure that the sector works. There were concerns a couple years ago about avian influenza in the United States, and typical country would say, okay, what parts of the United States is this taking place? Let's not import from them, but can import from other places. And the Cubans just turned it all off because this is a vulnerable spot for them. So in conclusion, this TSRA Act of 2000 allowed for the resumption of U.S. agricultural exports to Cuba. Exports increased up to about $685 million in 2008, sort of a rough year for Cuba, and then declined from that level to $149 million in 2015, and preliminary evidence suggests it's going to rebound to $195 million total for this past year. There have been many efforts over the past several years to update the U.S.-Cuba relationship. With a more normal trading relationship, U.S. agricultural exports to Cuba would likely diversify and increase in total size, and we would, you know, it would be normal that we would be importing agricultural products from Cuba. And it's important to recognize in the current time how important it is that policies in both countries influence bilateral agricultural trade. That's it. Thank you.
Okay, I think I get to use this. Can everybody hear me okay? Can you hear me in the back? A little more? I don't know how to use it. He's got it. Okay. Well, buenas tardes. I'm Mari Caro. I am the regional director for the U.S. Grains Council based in the Panama City, Panama office. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Cuba today. But before I do that, I just want to introduce myself and maybe talk a little bit about the U.S. Grains Council. How many of you are familiar with who the U.S. Grains Council is? Oh, a little more than I thought. That's great. So I'll just briefly touch on it. But I'm Mari Caro. I'm from a corn and soybean farm in southwest Minnesota. We had a farrow to finish farm operation when I was growing up, and now we just have the nursery, which my brother overtook. And I graduated with a degree in English literature. I tried very hard to leave the farm.
I moved all the way to Colorado, but something about it just pulled me right back in. I started my first job out of college working for the Minnesota Corn Growers Association in the communications department. Moved to Washington, D.C. sometime about 2008, became the director of communications for the U.S. Grains Council. And for the last 2.5 years, I've been in the Panama City, Panama office, working on developing markets for you all, for all of your corn and sorghum, grain, and related products. So a little bit about the U.S. Grains Council. Our mission is to develop markets, enable trade, and improve lives. What that means, of course, we develop markets, and that's what I'm going to be talking about in Cuba. That's a perfect example of a developing market where there's an exponential amount of opportunity for growth, as Steve has just mentioned. Well, I don't know, a questionable amount of room for growth, perhaps, depending on how policies will turn out and what the future brings for the country. Enabling trade, an example of that would be Colombia, for example. Maybe it was late last year they put a trade restricting barrier on imports of ethanol from the United States. Ethanol, of course, is a corn and sorghum product that we are very happy to grow here in the U.S. and export around the world. And it is in violation of our agreement with Colombia. So we work with the governments in between the U.S. and with the Colombian government to help them understand and to help work out whatever internal policies of why that they had put the barrier on in the first place. These kind of enabling trade activities is what we do. And, of course, improving lives. Like I said, I'm from a corn soybean farm up in Minnesota, and I think about my dad every day and, you know, what I'm doing around the world and helping to develop the markets and enable access to our products in my part of the world and improving the life of my family, you know, and more broadly your family, your livelihoods, and, of course, all of the people that we work with overseas, and making sure that they are profitable as well. So it's a great mission that we stand by. It's an organization I'm very proud to work for. Just a little bit about how we're funded. We have a few major funding sources, of course. We are funded by the growers of corn, barley, sorghum. Those are the commodities that we represent and the products of such. So we have state checkoff boards, and one national checkoff board. Sorghum is a national checkoff, and of course we have grower associations like our partners here, American Farm Bureau. Thank you, American Farm Bureau, for your loyal membership in the U.S. Grains Council, and for all that you do for us on the home state. We also have a agribusiness component of our membership, life science companies, ethanol plants, ABCDs, the trading houses, who else we have, Case IH. We had John Deere for a while. I think they might have dropped, so if there's any John Deere representatives here in the room, we're really happy to have you back. But we're one of the only cooperators that also has the agribusiness component involved in our membership as well. And of course, our largest funding member is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This is where the term of the cooperator or the theory of the cooperator program is the most unique in that it is a public and private partnership. Without our membership contributions, the U.S. government would not give us the funding that they do to allow us to work overseas. So they really have to go hand in hand. We need the support of our members in order to have the support of our government. And we are funded through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, through the Farm Bill, under two major programs, the Market Access Program and the Foreign Market Development Program. So I know the 2018 Farm Bill is coming into play soon, so we're very reliant on our members like the American Farm Bureau to help negotiate those policies to keep our programs active and so we can keep working for you in the international market. I think that's it. Oh, where we are. Here's where we are. We have 10 offices all over the world. We have consultants in many other countries, maybe 15, 17, something like that. And we have programs in more than 50 different countries. My office is here, Panama City, and I cover all of the export markets outside of the United States, minus Mexico. So it's just this small part of the world over here. and I'm very happy to have Cuba part of my portfolio. You know, Cuba has been a very difficult market for us, as Steve has explained. And actually, I have to thank Steve for doing all of the heavy lifting for the presentation, so I'm just going to skip to the fun stuff of what we're actually doing in the country and not focus too much on the background. But, you know, one of the major obstacles that we as the U.S. Grains Council have is being able to actually do stuff in Cuba because of the relationship between the two nations. We cannot use U.S. government funding to actively promote products in Cuba. Plus, I'm an American citizen. It's hard for me to just get on a plane and go there. I do have staff, Colombian staff, Panamanian staff, Brazilians, and Costa Ricans, etc., who are able to head over to Cuba when we need to. But it does limit our approach, especially when we want to do trade missions in the area. We want to do any kind of trade servicing in the area. Any kind of basic regular training of farming techniques and practices, and it really hinders us. So, you know, we're not allowed to lobby. Like I said, we're really thankful for our membership to take care of us on the home front, but it is something for you all to know that it is extremely restrict our abilities for success in the region. Steve talked about the situation in Cuba, so I'm just going to kind of skip through some of these slides. How many of you have been to Cuba? Oh, quite a few. Any impressions anybody wants to share of what they saw while they were there? You have anything you want to share?
People are very friendly. I noticed when we were there in February and March of 14, small farmers been able to work a small part of the ground. In 2010, they weren't. And in my opinion, what I've heard about the embargo, Cuba has to pay for it before they get it delivered. If they get rid of the embargo, they can buy it on credit. Is that right?
Exactly, yep.
Okay. Yeah. So that would be a big step to clear out of the way.
Yeah, Veronica's going to handle that. Yeah, back there.
In response to another question on his comment, I have read on there that Cuba has not received a favored nation status on trade, and I appreciate it. Now, if we were to give it where they could buy on credit, how trading with anyone is dependent on getting your money for the product delivered. If we lift that and give them favored nation status or whatever the qualification, buy goods on credit, they say our imports or exports
like a guarantee?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great question. And, you know, I don't know, Veronica, if you've got things you want to discuss on it, but it's going to have to evolve over time. There's going to need to be some third-party banks involved and an established trust system. I know some companies in Mexico that have businesses in Cuba that have very functional relationships, and getting money out of Cuba is extremely difficult. So it's not that they don't want to pay, it's just getting the cash, getting the money out of Cuba. So yeah, there will need to be a progression of change that will have to go in that way.
You said there will need to be. Did anyone have an initiative after how to solve this problem?
Well, there are some government programs, like the GSM 102 program. I don't know, Steve, if you want to talk about that. No, he doesn't. But there are some programs for cash, you know, credit guarantee programs. When it comes down to the actual sale of trade, it really comes down to the buyer and the seller, and you develop trust over time. If you're a grain buyer, which of course that's where my knowledge comes from, is grain buying. You're not buying grain one time. You're buying it for a lot. So you're not going to want to, pardon my French, screw your supplier, right? Or buyer, vice versa. So you trade is a relationship. It's not a one time action. Well, if it is a one time action, then you know what will happen. Yeah.
You mentioned
No,
one time they were real anxious to see us trade more aggressively.
I'm not sure. Maybe. Yeah. Like I said, the actual transaction between buyer and seller is done between buyer and seller, and there are some government U.S. government programs that they can get involved in, but I am not sure if the Bank of Canada is one of those trusted banks. Right now, my impression is that we're not allowed to use the U.S. government programs in terms of credit. So they'll need to. That's the change that will need to happen. Any other impressions? Yeah.
I've been to Cuba four times. First two times I went, an officer of U.S. Sweet Associates, and they really rolled out the red carpet. That was in 2003, as you mentioned in your slide, started in 2000. 2003, 4, 5, and 6, they were really promoting trade in the United States. Your question is good about funding. Who would want to send them wheat? In my situation, we were trying to sell them wheat, and they really wanted wheat. They were buying it from Canada and France and other places in the world, which had to go through a third world bank. They have cash money in bank, and if you notice, their exports are in cigars and nickel, and I forget some other products, but cigars mainly. They have a lot of cash in the French banks or the German banks, and so the way that works, they fill a ship with wheat and somewhere in Florida or the Gulf, it's 90 miles across from the Gulf to Havana. It's about a 5-day trip. They fill it, and before they can unload that in Havana, the money has to be transferred from that German bank to, say, Cargill. Well, the problem is I met with Castro the first two times at his presidential palace for 2.5 hours, talking with him back and forth. He wanted to buy my wheat. He didn't want a lot of different classes of wheat. He wanted special wheat. Said, I don't have enough wheat to send you, but neighbors and I can do it. And so we sent him, I was in on the negotiation to send a shipload of wheat to them when we could do it. Now I see there's no exports to Cuba in the last year. So they really shut it down. But at that time you could send food and pharmaceuticals over there. And so that's how we were able to take wheat in. It was pretty neat on the negotiations. They're just like trading for a tractor. They say, what do you want for your wheat? Here's what we'll give. You just kind of split the difference. That's how it all happened. Logistics was a big thing. But
interesting story.
But it is. It's a neat market, and I hope we can use it.
Yeah. Any other impressions of Cuba? Yeah.
I was there in 2015. We got to go out the countryside and see Cuban agriculture, see the farms. And Cuban agriculture needs everything. You know, we think about the things that we need, but you know, they need inputs. They want our seeds, our technology. They want fertilizers. They want to buy equipment. The equipment that we saw in the countryside was old, dilapidated Russian tractors and those types of things. The problem is they don't have cash to buy with. And one government official said, you know, we want to buy all your things, we want to trade with you. However, we don't want our farmers buying so much stuff that they get into financial trouble. So I think there's a lot of opportunity in Cuba. You know, they would like to buy our inputs so they can raise their own crops, but they also need to buy foodstuffs. You know, rice is one of the things that they were really wanting to buy. Buying it from Vietnam currently, or they were at that time, said we could get Missouri rice, ship it out of the Gulf, be here in 2 days, buying it from Vietnam. It's poor quality when it goes on the ship. It takes 30 days to get there. It's even in worse quality shape when they get it. So the market is there. We just need to get things worked out so that we can take advantage of it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's hard to have millions of dollars up front when you don't have millions of dollars.
Yeah.
So it's a reality that it needs to be put into perspective. Thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah.
I was there about 4 years ago, and we went to study the art because that's the only way you could get there unless you went to
I'm sorry, did you say the art?
Canada.
Ah, okay.
I'm wondering, it's kind of a two-class system there. The tourism was their big industry, and then they were trying to take good care of them. They had good highways, they had good hotels. And so if we could get into that, I think there's money to support that, but I don't, it wouldn't amount to probably very much, and it would be maybe more process stuff. And then the common people, you know, the doctors are driving taxi cabs to get enough money to fill up, and 20% of the food stamps would have enough to get by on for the needs. So money with the common people is really limited now on the government end, but I don't know how that works out.
Yeah. Well, it is a highly literate country, like you said, 99.7%. It's incredible. You're right. Taxi. I'm not sure if I've seen doctors drive taxi cars. Excuse me, taxis. but I know when I've been there, the taxi drivers and the tour guides and everybody knew everything about their country and their history. Now I live in Panama, and I have a personal relationship with the Panamanians, but they don't know their history, and a lot of Americans don't know their history. I don't know. I can't say I know everything about U.S. history either. But the Cubans know their country. They know what they're very, very impressive culture. But yes, money is an issue. Yes. Yeah, yeah, you're right. Yeah, the medical school is good. I just want to show. I know we're running out of time. I just want to show some charts of what you all exactly are talking about. I just think the one picture I'll point out here. It's not a very good quality picture. The one in the middle at the bottom is people waiting outside of an internet cafe, and people will stand in lines for a long time to get access to the internet cafe, and sometimes people will buy them, they'll buy them for, what did I put up there, 4.5 kooks per hour, and then they'll sell them to tourists for 10 kooks per hour. So, you know, it's changing. Availability of internet is changing, but it's still very expensive. It's very slow. And if you walk down the streets, for those of you who have been there, you know, you walk down the street in D.C. and everybody's on their phone. They're almost running into people or traffic, et cetera. But in Cuba, you don't see that. Like, people aren't on their phones. They're not walking around with their phones, which, you know, is, you know, somewhat refreshing, but also really frustrating when you're somebody like me and I need to get in touch with you and I want to know what's going on. I'm setting up a meeting. I'm on a comm. I want to find out information for this presentation, how's it going in your business, et cetera, et cetera. It's a really difficult market to work in for these really simple limiting issues. Grain market situation, that's what I'm going to talk about. We're, you know, as Steve mentioned, we're losing a good market in terms of corn, and I'll show you a number here in just a second, but we're definitely losing to our suppliers in the south. There has been a return in corn from corn purchases in Cuba this year, mostly because of Brazil's short supply, which is only going to be temporarily lived. Logistics, of course, you could just basically just push a boat from New Orleans and it would get to Havana or the Port of Mariel. Lack of credit availability, lack of knowledge of some of the products that are available in the feed ingredients. These are issues that we are focusing on and we are working on. This is a quick look at the GDP growth. It's the second largest corn market in the Caribbean. I really appreciated that Steve lumped in the comparison of the Dominican Republic to the Cuba market. We like to do that too. We like to think of that area kind of as a follower's market or a leader's market, depending on how you want to look at it, because a lot of times when a supplier is shipping a boat to that part of the world, if the origin is going to be switched, it will impact the rest of the region. So we do look at the region somewhat of a whole, although there are obvious barriers. Some is an English-speaking Caribbean, some is a Spanish-speaking Caribbean. There's cultural differences. There's a lot of trade agreement, you know, DR agreement. U.S. and Jamaica have very good trade relationships, et cetera. But anyway, this is a a chart looking at that. Population, you know, population, they had last year, they were even showing a negative population due to emigration happening, but they're starting to be a little more positive now of where their population will go. This is just a, you know, an estimate, not too much growth, but some growth. Here's a look at tourism, our projection on tourism. You can see here, between, you know, December of 2014 until 2015 is almost doubling in U.S. tourism going into Cuba. So that's just, you know, pretty much overnight growth. I think it was the first 3 months or so of the 2015 year, first quarter, something like that, where the 35% had it already increased of U.S. Folks going into Cuba. Of course, a lot of you have been there. How many of you have been there since Obama's trade change in 2014? And was that your first time there? Mine too. So, you know, there's a lot more interest going into the market, a lot more of us going down there and checking it out. GDP growth you talked about. There's all over in Latin America, we experienced a GDP growth. Well, Latin America in general had about a 10 years of really great GDP growth. I can't remember exactly the number, but maybe it was between like 6% and 7%. But then 2000, you know, China stopped buying all kinds of minerals, which is huge export out of, especially out of, you know, Ecuador and Colombia and Peru and all and Chile. And so, and of course, if you haven't seen the news, what's happening in Brazil, you know, the declining real, there's a lot of situation happening in the area. Corruption is a major theme in Central America. So 2014, 15, and 16 were rough years in general for the region. And anyway, we're starting to be a little more optimistic for the future into the Cuba market, specifically for GDP. And here's corn production. There is a U.S. Grains Council app if you are interested in doing the conversion from hectares to acres and bushels to metric tons. But Veronica says I need to move forward, so I'm going to move forward. Anyway, the point being, and as you had mentioned, there's some opportunity there for them to increase their yields. My theory on that is we already grow corn, and we're so close, and we've got a lot of it. Cuba should be focusing on higher value products that we don't have here in the United States in order to become a more competitive trade or a more attractive trade partner. That's my opinion. I want to get to corn. Okay, here we are. The U.S. had a really great corn market. You know, Cuba's a million-ton market. If it were, well, like 900,000 tons. I'm just going to call it a million ton. We like to say, well, the headquarters likes to say, but I'm going to use their talking point. If we were to capture 100% of the Cuba market share, they would be our 12th largest corn export market globally. So it's not a small market. It's not a big market, but it's not a small market. And like I said, it's just a boat's throw away from our market, from our ports, the main ports, excuse me, and it's right in our backyard. It's a market that we should continue to focus on. So we used to have a 60-70% market share or so, and then that dropped down quite significantly to zero. and we're happy to see some returns, but of course that's all on, you know, credit and what's going on in Brazil and supply and demand. So there'll need to be changes like we were just talking about in order for us. We are really, really have our hands tied in that way. Here's a look at some numbers. You can see where it's all coming from. Argentina, Brazil, they're taking up our product there. Jamaica, DR. Jamaica is a reliable supplier of U.S. corn. There's two major buyers there. They're pretty happy with the U.S. quality corn. The DR is another focus of mine. It's a sad story that maybe Veronica will invite me back later. I'll tell you all about it. Now is the unfair part of my presentation, where I'm going to throw like four or five charts at you in numbers, and then you can forget all about it. But here's our estimates of what's happening in terms of production. Here's egg production, poultry. That's where the U.S. Grains Council is going to spend a lot of its focus over the next year, 2 years, and Steve had mentioned there was some government programs going too, so we'll work hand in hand with FAS. Swine, some opportunities for swine growth, of course, and milk as well, in terms of the milk. I deleted a slide, but processed milk as well, processed dairy products as well, and the beef. I think the major driver of this is going to be tourism. You know, people coming in demanding more high quality products, beef products. Of course, beef is extremely expensive, and as we were just discussing, it's a poor country. So this is going to be mainly driven by tourists, in my opinion. So our market barriers, of course, we have the embargo. We have the lack of access to cash. We have the restricting policies from our government, where we can't use MAP or FMD. That's the two government programs I was telling about that fund the U.S. Grains Council. And the lack of understanding of the U.S. export system, the whole grain processing system. We call it buying blind. They're not, because of the restrictions, the buyers are not allowed necessarily to come to the United States freely, check out the product. Okay, yeah, that looks good. I understand what FGIS is doing, what our Federal Grain Inspection Service is doing. I understand the certification process. I understand how my contract is working. They don't have the opportunity to do that. So, just the complete lack of understanding of how our processes work is a trade restricting barrier. Allenport here, and these are our buddies. We were very successful in having our first ever mission of the Allenport folks coming to the United States. This happened last spring. Here they are on a river boat in the Mississippi River. That's me there with my buddies. But that was a really great mission. It was the first time that we were able to take them to FGIS. Here's how it happens. Here's the little room they sit in and inspect the grain, and here's the certification process. Here's what a contract looks like. Here's who you're buying from. Introduced them to buyers and sellers. We took them up to into Missouri and showed them the transportation system, met some farmers. Here's from production all the way to the port and into the government policies. I'll leave this with the Farm Bureau, and this is just a little bit of what we've done in the past. We've been active in the Cuba market for 20 years with limited ability. And this is what we are doing since I've been in the office, in the Panama office. And this year what we're gonna be working on is doing an assessment of the feed production and internal transportation system, and of course the poultry sector, as I mentioned. So, and of course we have continuous ongoing networking opportunities. Now what we're trying to do, we're very limited in being able to bring people into Cuba and to show them, bringing Cubans into the United States and vice versa, bringing people to Cuba for general grain basic classes and trading classes. So we have a trade school happening in Colombia. So we're able to bring them to Colombia. We have one going on in Guatemala. We're able to bring them to Guatemala. So regionally, we can have those kinds of opportunities, of course, on our membership funds and not the U.S. government funds. And that is my presentation. Veronica says I have 0 minutes left, but I don't know if we have time for questions or if anyone wants to make any more observations.
I was just wondering why you don't have Mexico.
Oh, well, that's a great question. I used to have Mexico, and then they kicked me out of there. No, I'm teasing. it's a big region, and Mexico is a number one buyer of corn this year. They outpaced Japan. Japan's been an extremely loyal buyer, and we have an office in Mexico, and we just hired an assistant director in Mexico. So we felt very comfortably just letting the Mexico office handle Mexico, and I can handle all of the other 36 markets that I have. So it was one less market, but that's a great question. Veronica, you want to talk about
sure.
that?
Sure. Actually, I think Mari and Steve have done a good job kind of talking about the market overview, but when it gets into the dirty, nasty political stuff, that's Dave's
job. That's not dirty
job.
And nasty.
Dave, all right. Thank you.
Real quick. I'll do this real quick. I'm Dave Solomonson. I'm the work on the trade issues for American Farm Bureau and handle Cuba, and I'm also head of the legislative committee for the U.S. Ag Coalition for Cuba. That is a question we don't know. Of course, starting in December of 14, the Obama administration relaxed some things. We've worked hard since then. You know, we have policy in Farm Bureau, very good, one-sentence policy, one of the clearest policies, which I love as a staff person, that says we support normal trade and travel with Cuba. You know, for that's awful, awful clear. And so we have policy. We are in favor of getting rid of the embargo. We're in favor and pushed legislation last year, not successfully, but trying to address the ag credit financing issue, make it easier to sell into Cuba, as Steve Murray talked about. But we don't know what the new administration will bring. Certainly there's been some, you know, you very quickly working on Capitol Hill and talking anything with Cuba. We'll go up there as an ag coalition. We'll start talking about agriculture. You don't get a minute in before somebody wants to talk about something else, whether it's politics, whether it's claims, whether it's all the other things that have gone on, you know, in this relationship that started changing, as was pointed out by Steve, in 59. President Eisenhower started the first action. He put the embargo on our exports. President Kennedy in 62 put the embargo on imports. Over time, they were codified legislatively. We had the TISFRA bill legislation in 2000. We had a limited exemption to the embargo we could sell, but it's an awful lot of politics wrapped up in this. Of course, now we've exchanged, you know, we have a full embassy instead of an interest section, which we had there before. But Congress, let us say, is a little reluctant to move on this issue. I think a lot of that was this, of course, this last year being an election year, and we're not sure of the new administration's attitude towards this. We hope they don't go backwards on it. We're not sure if at any rate they'll move forward. So that is something we will be working on, but we don't know that yet. Martin?
What about the, how about kind of avoiding the the directly political side that does impact? How about the socio-political side, the divide even among Cuban Americans that affect movement progress on the politicization of Cuban trade?
Oh, I think you're probably referring to some of the politics from some of the state in Florida and such of that. Yeah, there's. I think that's some of the skepticism of moving ahead, and that's been there a long time and will continue. So. Another question. I'll stop on that.
Stephen, I've got a question for you.
Okay. This will be the last question.
If Cuban exports of fruits and vegetables and other ag products to the U.S. were to increase substantially, how confident are you in the ability of the Cuban government to prevent the contamination of those products with pests and diseases?
So I can't answer, you know, sort of a level of